All right, Genesis chapter 9. We're going to look at 9, 10, and 11 this evening. And hopefully we can get that far. If we don't, that'll be all right. But we're going to try to get through this because there's obviously Genesis chapter 12. We begin a pivot within the book because we are introduced in the last part of 11 and introduced in a major way to the remaining major character in Genesis of Abraham and the great significance that he plays in God's eternal plan, and he is introduced to us in Genesis 12. But we've got to get there, and we've got a big event to cover tonight in chapter 11. so we've got our work cut out for us, including getting my first slide to come up. All right, when we look at Genesis 9, I want to go back and make sure we hit on this before we get out of this chapter. And this is one of the major themes. Again, always look at, as you read through Genesis, why is this here? What does it mean for Israel? What does it mean for us? And try to distill out the lessons that Moses is presenting for God in his presentation of the facts within Genesis. And so when we look at Genesis chapter 9, one of the major themes that we talked about very early in the introductory material comes right at us here. And this is the major theme of that Yahweh is a God of covenants. All right? And we're going to see the Noahic or the flood covenant in Genesis chapter 9 is a good one to look at as a type study of what are these covenants all about that God makes with people, and why does he do that, and why is that important for Israel to know, why is that important for mankind and us in general to know, and what is being introduced here by Moses for all, you know, for us to understand about the nature of God. There's a lot in this behind all of that is behind what God decides to do with man through contracts or covenants. You know, that term covenant is almost a religious word, isn't it? We don't rarely use those unless you're talking about the covenants in a homeowners association. But really what that is, it's a contract you sign up for, okay? And maybe we would be more comfortable if we called it divine contracts, because that's in essence what you're doing. When you become a Christian, you make a contract. You make a contract with Jesus Christ to be his disciple, don't you? And maybe that's a way to determine it. But I've got four things up here that we need to always remember when about all covenants of God. And this is four things I want us to hit on very quickly. But when we look, first of all, at Genesis chapter 9, when you read through Genesis chapter 9 in the chapter, seven times in this chapter, God speaks of making a covenant. That's mentioned, that word is used seven times in this chapter. And I'm kind of a numbers guy, right? I kind of get very much that way. But when I see in a section of Scripture, such as one chapter, a single word, like when you get over to Paul's epistles and you see faith or grace and it's mentioned seven times in one chapter, you know that Paul is emphasizing and pushing hard on the subject of faith. And so when you come here, Genesis chapter 9, seven times in the telling of this narration concerning God and his interacting with Noah after the flood, he mentions the word covenant. So obviously the word, the idea of a covenant or a contract between God and Noah or God and man is very important to God right after the flood is completed. So we know that God is a maker of covenants. Now we know that the concept of covenant, tokens, terms, and durations are all essential to Israel to know and to understand. And it's even more so, if that's possible, for us to comprehend it today. Because as I mentioned before, we are involved in covenants with God. So we've got to understand how God looks at covenants, because we're in one. and we wouldn't want to make a mistake and abuse it. So that's the reason why we want to spend a little time looking at this. Number one, God bothers to make them, covenants with man. In Psalms 8, David marvels that God goes to the trouble to bother with man. It's a very interesting psalm that David writes. And he's intrigued, basically, with the walk away. God, why are you so engaged with man? You're so high. You're divine. You're so holy. You're so just. And we are so not. God is so great, man is so puny. God is so lovely, man is so ugly. Why does God bother? Because God's a lover. God is love, and He loves man. He loves us. And it's out of love He created, and it's out of love He creates fellowship. That love passes knowledge and understanding, Ephesians chapter 3. But these covenants or these contracts give us clues into the love of God. Secondly, God as sovereign is always the initiator of the covenants. Does man ever get to write a covenant with God? I'm going to write the contract, God. Here's the following terms. You have to do this, you have to do this, and if you do this, this happens. If you do this, this happens. And if you don't do this, then this happens, and this happens, and this happens. Man doesn't get to do that, do they? No, that's not how it works. The Creator is the one who creates these covenants and contracts. And He bothers to even deal with us, but He deals with us within this way. Because you know why? We need structure. Man needs structure. Man needs some contracts. Man needs some terms in which to understand in man's limited way who God is and what does He expect from us. And so in our limited understanding, He explains them to us through this means. And He is sovereign and He initiates them. Look at chapter 9 and verse 9. And I establish my covenant with you and your seed after you. Pretty straightforward, isn't it? Who's the creator of the covenant that the rainbow is centered around here after the flood? God. All right? And he says, it's my covenant, and I'm making it, and I'm making it with you and your seed. And that would include us, wouldn't it? Do you ever think you're involved in a contract concerning the rainbow? Or do you just kind of look at that, oh, that's old history, and it's just happening now because it happened, God put it in place then, and it's still happening, but we really don't think about that when we see rainbows. You're in this contract. I'm in this contract. God said what is associated with that token of this contract. There's other contracts that have tokens also. The token of this contract is the rainbow. But what's in the token? What does that represent? What's the terms in the contract? Promise of what? Not to do what again?
Not to destroy the earth and everything in it
with water. With water. Not to destroy not only man, but all the animals and all the things of His creation by water ever again. With wholesale correction because of man's evil. Again, think about man's sin and man's impact of his sin upon God's creation. When I say man is ugly, I think that's the best way to describe that ugly. God created paradise. Look what man did to it. God created the world. Look what man did to it by the time of Noah. And what did God have to do to amend that, fix that? So He is sovereign. He initiates these. He will say that this is His covenant again in chapter 9. He'll say it again in verse 11. So He said it in 9. He'll say it in 11. He'll say it in verse 12. He'll say it in verse 17. This is my covenant that I'm making with you. And man doesn't bring God to these covenants under necessity. A a gracious and sovereign Lord is coming and choosing to bring himself into this covenantal relationship with us. Because we don't have any collateral, do we? Do we have any bargaining chips with God? You know, sometimes contracts are made, and I worked in my career, I worked in a very union-oriented industry, okay? Air traffic control. We had a very strong union. And what did we have every 4 years that came up? A contract. And that contract every year, or every 4 years, kept getting bigger and thicker and more delineated and changes. And they would come in and the union would argue hard for a certain thing they really, really wanted. And management would come in and argue really hard to take something back that they had given back before. And it was a lot of give and take. And eventually, over a period of maybe even a year, you would hammer out all these articles of this contract. Because both sides were vested. We both had interests and collateral into that contract. But what do we have with God? We have no collateral with God. He is creator. We are his created. And so if the covenant has terms or conditions within it, whichever covenant we're talking about, if there's terms and conditions within it, they're not negotiable because we have nothing to negotiate with. And thankfully, the individual who is creating this contract and covenant for us is just and full of love for us. And so what he puts in it is, even though it may feel limiting or in some way modifying of what we may want to do in our lives, it's for our best because God has our best interest in mind. We don't understand it always, and we don't see it from our perspective, but from his greater eternal perspective, he knows what's best for us. And so luckily for us, God is our sovereign, initiates the contracts. Thirdly, in these contracts or covenants, God is lovingly seeking, and here's another theme again, this idea of fellowship. Because what does covenants do? It creates what? Relationships, doesn't it? I mean, back to my work illustration. In that contract, it created very specifically. In fact, we had a definition of terms that would be used within that contract. When you see this, it means these people. When you see this, it means these people. When you see this, it means these people have to do these things. And it really works out the interworkings of the relationship of the entire community that's under that contract or covenant, right? And so, when God creates a covenant, he does the same thing. He's creating a community of people that are within that covenant or within or under that contract. And so, it's this idea of relationships and fellowship, right? And within this flood or post-flood covenant, the community is who? It's Noah and Noah's seed. It's all of us, isn't it? It's the immediate family, obviously, and all succeeding generations are under and within this community. So whatever benefits or cursings or tenets or limitations that are found within that covenant, everybody in the community is involved in that. You see that? Now, this is a very simple covenant. When we start talking about the covenant of the Mosaical covenant, got pretty complicated, didn't it? Got pretty thick, you know. Go read Leviticus or Deuteronomy. You start seeing the details. But all those details are just part of a covenant. They're a part of a covenant with God that is specific for a community who's within that covenant. Okay, but this is something that we will always see. He is lovingly seeking our fellowship. And lastly, by this means of covenants, God creates communities. Okay? And we're going to see that after the flood, God was interested in what? When Noah and his family came off the ark, he was interested in them doing what? Creating communities. Having fellowship, relationship with him under a covenant and certain things they needed to do, and he was going to help them do it. And when God helps us do something, what do we call that? blessing. He blesses us to do something. And so when we look at this, we see that God is going to bless them to carry out certain things that he wants them to do. And among those was to create communities. The text calls it what? Doing what? Being what? Being fruitful and multiply. And to do what else? To go out into all the world and do that. And develop and establish these communities for man. Okay? That was all part of this covenant right here in Genesis chapter 9. That was tokenly represented by the rainbow. It involved being blessed by God to be fruitful. He was going to help them multiply, which we're going to see when we start looking at Genesis chapter 10 and chapter 11. So-and-so begat so-and-so, begat so-and-so. When you read all that, can you walk away and go on, boy, God didn't help them be fruitful very much. These are grand illustrations of how he really, really blessed them to be fruitful and multiply, because these families are listed just continually. And so that will come into play when we get over Genesis chapter 11, when we see man balk at the terms of this covenant. Okay? They're going to balk at this covenant eventually. And they're going to say, we're glad you're blessing us. We're really happy with being fruitful. Thank you. But we're not so sure we want to scatter anymore. Right? And we're going to see that on the plains of Shinar, also known as the Tower of Babel. But it all comes back to this point right here in Genesis chapter 9. God set a covenant. He established a rainbow to remind them of that covenant. And he said, be fruitful, multiply, and scatter onto the earth. That was all part of that covenant. All right. So that's here in Genesis chapter 9. I didn't want to get past that without kind of laying that background of what's behind what we're going to read in chapter 10 and what we're going to read in chapter 11. All right. So Yahweh is a God of covenants. It's interesting that right before we read in chapter 9 of this covenant down about verse 11, he talk about up there in about verses 4 through 7? Did y'all notice that? Before he gets into this covenant with the rainbow and all of that, what does he touch on? Another very important concept here that's part of this blessing, part of this contract. Yeah, he introduces a very important concept, and that is this. The primacy of blood before God. Because what does he say here? But flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, ye shall not eat. And surely your blood, the blood of your lives, will I require. At the hand of every beast will I require it. And at the hand of man, even at the hand of every man's brother. There's a throwback to Cain and Abel's problem, wasn't it? Direct reference back to that. And what was that problem? He required Abel's blood at the hand of Cain, didn't he? Because what did Cain do? He murdered him. And so we have at the very beginning of this covenant the idea, whosoever sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. And you be fruitful and multiply. In other words, what does the taking of blood do to the covenant that's represented by the rainbow? What does murder do to the be fruitful and multiply? Kind of negates that, right? It's kind of working against God's covenant, isn't it? If I'm killing things, are they multiplying and being allowed to be fruitful? No. And he's directly calling out the idea concerning the primacy of blood and the idea of life for life and the idea of murder. Animals here are clearly, they're given as food, but in doing so, man must observe the principle of honoring the blood within the animal. And that is in here as well, if you read carefully through that. And God expands the explanation toward man himself. Man is not to discount the sanctity of blood of human life. And if they do, they're in violation of this covenant. So, this will be a principal building block for the Mosaical sacrificial system that we've recently studied some, right? Under both the law and the covenant of Moses, and also how we can understand the law and covenant of Christ. But it is stated here in connection with the blessings of man and the covenant of the rainbow. Okay, got a question for you with that then. Question is it still in force today? Are the concepts we see in Genesis chapter 9, starting about verse 4, down through about verse 7 or 8, and then we get into the actual, I will make and establish this covenant in verse 11. Is that covenant and these elements that we're just now talking about, is that still in force today? This idea of sanctity of blood is the concept I'm pointing at here. Is that still in force today?
God does still have the view that the life is in the blood, and they're very tied together. Sanctity of life, life is precious to him, should be protected. Since those principles are coming.
I have to give this a definitive emotional answer of yes. Absolutely 100%. This covenant and those elements of this covenant are still in force today. Number one, I still see rainbows. Indicates to me that the covenant is still in place. Secondly, I can't understand Christianity if I don't understand the primacy and sanctity of life. Because that statement allows me to put primacy, utmost primacy, upon the blood of Christ. Think of it that way, folks. If I can discount the sanctity of blood, what makes the blood of Christ so special? It attacks that. It erodes the principles associated with that. And so the sacrificial system starts to corrode or crumble that obviously was nailed to the cross and Christ supplanted and replaced with his blood. But again, the whole basis of all that is life is sacred. God created it and it is sacred. And this covenant brings that out. So yes, I believe it is in force today. And we need to look at Christianity and everything that we're taught through the love or the law of Christ, through that lens of Genesis chapter 9. Okay, when we see what happened, Larry?
Again, I'm just thinking out loud here. I could be off the rails somewhere down the woods. I see this covenant and talking about what God would not do in terms of the flood. And I've never thought of it as expanding to the first part of chapter 9. Then that may well be true. It's very interesting. I've always thought of the covenant in this case of God just limiting himself. Obviously, God stated this, and it's going to be true for all mankind. And so I guess you still get to the same place with it. But I'm just in my thinking. I've always thought of this covenant being a little more narrow. But again, that's a thought I have, and it doesn't really affect any of the points you made, but it's just...
Why would God say it's important for them to know, I'm not going to destroy animals anymore with water in this way. I'm not going to destroy man in this way. Why is that so important? Okay, that's what I'm getting behind it. Why is it so important? I'll tell you why, because he told us in verse 4. The sanctity of blood is why God is not going to do this with water anymore. Could he do it because he's the creator of all things and owns everything? Yes, absolutely could. Could he be just in what he does? Yes, because we're sinful people. But God has made a covenant with us. He's not going to do it, and he's trying to explain here what's behind that. And that is, there's some principles that God gives us here that I think it's more than just, he's just not going to let it rain a lot anymore. You know, I think there's more to it than that.
Another question, talk again. I'm very fascinated. We do this reading, you know, like I say. Mm-hmm. But the covenant is not only made
Yeah, very specifically, he discusses animals here. Yeah. And, you know, you can dig through this, and there's not a lot here for us to kind of pull threads on, but it seems to me that there is some indication that the relationship between man and animal, post-flood versus pre-flood, is going to be a little different. To what extent that is different, I'm not sure. There's been lots of movies made about it, but I think there is indication that it's different. Is that what you're alluding to?
I mean, I'm just noting it. It's,
yeah.
I'm not sure
yeah.
I've got anywhere I'm going with it. The only place I would go with it would be, you know, being responsible, not being cruel, not
mm-hmm.
just, you know, maybe talk about
mm-hmm.
truly taking care of nature and,
right.
you know.
Hunting for food, not a problem.
No.
Says so right here. Hunting for trophy sport, interesting conversation for me to have. Now you're back to it's you're back into reason one, okay. If I'm out there taking life for the joy and pleasure, tell me again how I'm fulfilling the rainbow covenant in Genesis chapter 9 and verse 4 through 6, 7. Am I showing sanctity of life by doing that? I'm just going to leave that for y'all to think about. I haven't really thought a lot through that. I'm not sure I'm ready to paint myself totally in that corner, but I think I could give a safe answer.
One more thought of this, and that is no more just eating vegetables.
Yeah, clearly. Clearly. The idea of before the flood, lots of things changed with the flood. The idea of every plant is given to you for food is now expanded here in Genesis chapter 9. Now, you may want to be a vegetarian. That's your right. Health-wise, there's probably some great benefits to that. But there is this allowance for that. But again, the nature between animals and man seems to have changed. Julie? Right, right. Well, it would be a good example of that. I ran into this on a trip to Ireland before I retired. I was over in Dublin for, I don't know, a week or two. And the Brits and the Irish have a food over there. What's the name of that food? It's blood pudding. And there's also haggis. Okay. You know what's in that? You know what they use instead of a little bit of gravy or a little bit of water or milk to kind of make that? They use blood, okay? And that blood pudding has blood in it. And what did, and now I would say, okay, this probably, I shouldn't eat that because of this. But even that is reiterated even further forward in the book of Acts, right? What did the brethren in Jerusalem send to the brethren in Antioch who had some questions? And the issue was, you know, what are we going to tell them to do in their private lives as Gentiles? What do they need to do? There were only really two things they were told not to do. And that was involving idols, I think was one. And then the other was what? Not to eat things what? Strangled. Right? Because they'd be eating blood, and they would be violating Genesis chapter 9 and verse 4. Now, I don't know why James decided, of all the things to put on them, just these two things. Well, I do know, because I think it made sense. It's the righteous thing to tell them, instead of all these other mosaical limitations of things to follow and holy days to observe and things such as that. He goes all the way back to this right here and brings that forward. It says, all mankind is under this covenant, and here's a reminder of that. Blood is sacred, and you shouldn't be eating things that are strangled. Not because it was violating the Mosaical law. I believe it goes back beyond that, and he says, you're violating this law. Okay? Which was predating the Mosaical principle. Okay? Or contract. Okay. Let's look a little bit more at Genesis chapter 9 and wrap this chapter up. In verses 22 through 27, we got something we got to deal with. And that is this question. We see that after Noah came off the ark, he sinned. He got drunk, didn't he? And in his drunken state, he's naked. Okay? And in that nakedness, his son Ham sees his father, right? And obviously he is convicted as sinful activity with what he does. So it seems it's more than just this casual glance at his father. He does something to or with or in association with seeing Noah's nakedness that is wrong, inconceivably wrong, with Jehovah God. And so he is condemned for this in verse 24. And Noah awoke from his wine. It's funny things that you get into when you don't do what you should do in the first place. But he wakes up from his stupor, and he knew what his youngest son had done unto him. Okay? So that indicates pretty clearly that was more than just a passing glance. Oh, my father's taking off his clothes and he's drunk in his tent. And then he says in verse 25, and this is where I'm going with this. And he said, cursed, you'd think it'd say, cursed be Ham. But what does it say? Cursed be Canaan, who is the son of Ham. Okay? A servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren. And he said, blessed be Jehovah, the God of Shem, but let Canaan be his servant. God enlarge Japheth, the other brother, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, but let Canaan be his servant. And then we have the last verse written about Noah, about how long he lived. So my question for you is Canaan, the son of Ham, receiving the punishment for the sin of his father Ham here in Genesis 22 through 27? Do you understand the principle here? Is the son being sentenced for the crime of his father, the sin of his father? Because what's the Calvinistic term we would hear that described as? And the proof text that this is for some of them. Inherited sin. You ever hear that term before? Did Canaan inherit the sin of his father Ham and reap the consequences of Ham's sin upon Canaan? Okay, that's the dilemma of the question that we've got to, really, we need to tackle it here. Because it's about the clearest example of a case study that might point to, yeah, inherited sin is something that God does. So how do we answer that? Chris, you got a comment?
This may not cover all bases of what you're asking, if I understand what you're asking correctly. But it seems to me that the sin that Ham did was in showing disrespect for his father by even daring to look upon him. And then going out there and basically making fun, hey, I saw Dad lying there sinning, you know, stoned out of his mind, and he's lying there naked. Again, showing disrespect at a time when I would think this is pretty much the beginning of the patriarchal period.
Mm-hmm.
So to show disrespect to one's father would be a terrible thing. But as far as the sin goes, it may be that the idea being conveyed here is that his offspring will always be somewhat disrespectful. They aren't going to receive the idea of respect towards their elders in the same way that the families of Shem and Japheth would.
Right. And so that is a good explanation of this. I've read that explanation or words similar to that in what some others have said about this passage, and I think that's very much a part of the answer to this. No, I think it is in part. I think it is part of the answer because I don't have a a magic verse to point you at here. I'm going to take you to one in just a moment. I think it explains it pretty well over in Matthew chapter 23, because Jesus refers to this, okay, in essence. But I would say this. Well, I'll tell you what. Think about this. Again, what is the lesson for Israel here? We got this dilemma in front of us, this idea about inheriting or the sin of the father and the consequences of that sin coming upon the children. Can you think of any time where this is going to happen really soon after Mount Sinai? What are the children of Israel's original exiled Exodus previous slaves going to get ready to have to do, even though they weren't even involved in the decision? What are they going to have to do? Wander for how long? 40 days? 40 years. Half your life. You're going to have to endure something that you had nothing to do with, because your mama and your daddy didn't have the courage to take the land when Joshua and Caleb said they could and the 10 of them said you couldn't. And God said, for that cause, you're going to wander till all your parents die. And you had to wander for 40 years. And you might have been 6 years old when that happened. And you're going to be 46 when you cross the Jordan. Think how long that is. Okay? So, does the sin of the father, or by extension the mother, have consequences for the children? Does God protect the children from the sins of the parents? No. Sin has serious consequences. Sin is ugly, isn't it? How ugly is it, you might say? It is so ugly that it can affect multiple generations after them. Now, it could be here that we don't have the whole story about Ham and Canaan given to us by Moses, and that God just knew in his prescience that Ham was going to be bad and Canaan was going to be bad and they're going to always be bad, and so therefore this is pronounced almost as prophecy and he just takes care of it now. That's part of it, I think. I can't throw that out completely. But I really think when you go to Matthew chapter 23, and I want us to look at verse 29. Matthew 23, starting in verse 29, Jesus gives us a very good example of this. And when he talks to the Pharisees, and he says, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees," starting in verse 23, we'll read through 29, we'll read through 36. "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build sepulchres of the prophets and garnish the tombs of the righteous. And say, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we should not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Wherefore, you witness to yourselves that ye are sons of them that slew the prophets. Fill ye up then the measure of your fathers." Is Jesus here teaching inherited sin? That these scribes and Pharisees are guilty of the sins of their fathers who killed the prophets. Is he saying they're guilty because of inherited sin? Or is Jesus saying they're guilty because they're doing the same sin? Do you see the difference? If it's inherited sin, they could be guilty of what their fathers did in killing Elijah and Zechariah or Zephaniah. All right, well, let's read on. "Ye serpents, ye offspring of vipers, how shall ye escape the judgment of hell? Therefore, behold, I send unto you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them shall ye kill and crucify, and some of them shall ye scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, that upon you may come all the righteous blood," watch this, "shed on the earth from the blood of Abel, the righteous, unto the blood of Zechariah, son of Barchaniah, whom ye slew between the sanctuary and the altar. Verily I say unto you, all these things shall come upon this generation." What is Jesus saying to those Jews right there? He says you are going to receive the same condemnation as your forefathers. You may think that you would not behave as them, and you're standing here behaving just like them now, and you're going to, in this generation, behave just like them with prophets I'm going to send among them. You're going to scourge them in your synagogues. Anybody get scourged in a synagogue that we know of? Anybody get scourged in Jerusalem right after Pentecost? Peter and John specifically. Once they were scourged, they went out and they praised God that they could suffer for Christ, right? All these things are going to happen. Anybody get crucified in the coming days soon by these same men? Jesus himself did. What about Stephen? Do you think what he got was something that other prophets of old got by those fathers? Stoning? Sure he did. Jesus is making the point. They're going to be getting the same condemnation of the forefathers in the eyes of God because they did the same thing. And here's the thing. When you have a just and holy God as your judge, what does he do? You do the same crime, you get the same time. It's justice, isn't it? It's perfect justice. No partiality because it was old versus new. You did it. Here's the crime. Here's your sentence. You're doing the same thing, you're going to get the same sentence. Condemnation. Okay. Back over here then to what we see with Cain, I think, in that this generation of Jesus, how were they guilty of the blood of Abel? It's because they were doing the same kind of wickedness, same kind. All right. Obviously, they weren't guilty of killing Abel. We don't see that anywhere. So that's not what Jesus is teaching here. All right. So for me, this is the same point being made here that Jesus made. This is the same point that I think we see in Genesis chapter 9 with Ham and Canaan, just to kind of sum all that up. Canaan will repeat the same sins as Ham performs here, as you mentioned, Chris. Cain is going to do the same kinds of sin that Ham did. And so this pronouncement is coming upon Canaan because we're going to see Canaan. Is he going to be righteous at all, or his descendants righteous at all? Among those descendants, by the way, are the Amorites, okay, and many of the Jebusites and all of those. And so where did the land, ironically, the land of Canaan here, the man, becomes the land of what? Of Canaan. And who's dwelling in Canaan? Amorites, Jebusites, Amalekites, Canaanites, later Philistines. All of these people are descendants of Canaan. And what did Jesus or the Lord say to Abraham about when they went down, we're going to go down into Egypt, come back later, because what? The iniquity of the what was not full. The Amorite was not yet full, but in the fullness of times it would happen for them. And so Israel, why does Moses need to tell Israel this? Israel is getting ready to be the executioner of this judgment upon the children of Canaan when they enter the land. When God tells them to destroy every male, female, child and livestock of these children of Canaan when they conquer the land, this is why. Because their iniquity is full. And he is invoking judgment upon them that goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 9. Okay, big explanation there, but that's a tricky set of verses about Canaan and Ham and inherited sin versus consequential of Canaan's going to do the same kind of wickedness that Ham did. So he's going to get the same kind of punishment. And Jesus gives us that parallel teaching over in Matthew 23. This shows the principle here that really, I think, is involved. Okay, we're out of time, but comments or questions?
Yes, in a similar fashion where there was no guilt, but consequences on descendants, and that would be in Genesis 25, 23, where you had Isaac and Jacob in the birth. One, the older would serve the younger.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't happen in their lifetime, but their descendants God made judgments arbitrarily. Anyway, it's interesting if you look at that. It's not the individuals there. We were, I loved Jacob but hated Esau.
Mm-hmm.
It was really, in this case, dealing with the descendants. Not exactly the same parallel here, but when you see statements like that, you'll see we're talking about descendants.
Yes, absolutely. So, again, in summation of this little side trip we've taken in chapter 9 here, it's not inherited anything. It's Yahweh's divine, consistent, and holy justice that's really being explained by Moses here for us as well as for Israel to understand. It's an explanation so that they would have a better understanding of the God that Israel is to serve. And they're still being introduced to him at the foot of Mount Sinai when they first get this message of Genesis. Okay? Genesis chapter 9 is huge in understanding that nature of God for them to know and getting to know him. And so, you know, when you probably said, hey, let's study Genesis, you probably didn't think in your mind Genesis chapter 9 was probably the most important chapter in the book to understand. But I'll tell you, it's pretty close because of what all we see and learn about God and his covenants and how he's working and going to work with God's people here. And so much of it has tentacles that go into the future for Israel, and it's going to affect them. And the sad part about it is, in reading later, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and Judges, they didn't quite get it all. They didn't understand it as well as they should have. So hopefully we won't make that same mistake. Okay, we're going to pick up here next week in Genesis 10. I knew we wouldn't get through all this. I was like, oh man, I'm going to get not bogged down, but these are important conversations. And I want us to treat the book fairly while not treating it as a 52-week study on Wednesday night. We're going to look at this boring list of names in Genesis chapter 10 and 11. And I'm put up there as a question mark. You know, is it just a boring list of names of these genealogies? Anybody here like their genealogies? Anybody studied them? You got them family trees written out? How far back have you got it, Tara? Do you know? Not very far, but you're interested in it. It's fascinating, isn't it, to kind of track back. Where's my great-great-grandfather? So if you want a side trip someday here in Virginia, I'll give you mine. You can go down to Leesville, Virginia, between here and Lynchburg. Leesville Lake is just north of Smith Lake. There's two of them on that little river. The big one is Smith Lake, right? The little bitty one is Leesville Dam and Leesville Lake. Leesville is my family. And at the not the rich, famous Lees, by the way, of Virginia. That's not us. But Leesville is named after one of my ancestors. And there is a crossroads there of a general store with a four-way little stop sign. Last time I was there, 30-something years ago. And there's a frame little house right there. And that house was built by Captain John Lee, I'm sorry, of the Revolutionary War veteran that's in my family. And in their backyard is our family cemetery for him, his wife, and two of his daughters. And I have a photo of me and Amber, she's a little bitty squirt, standing at those tombstones. And so some in my family have gone way back in looking at our genealogy. And it's kind of neat when you get to come all the way back to 1600 and something in this country. I had branches of my family here doing these things, and I can go and see their tombstone. So genealogy are very important to some people, and I enjoy it, looking at them and knowing, hey, you know, I'm related to so-and-so, and, you know, I'm a direct descendant, second cousin, twice removed from Queen Elizabeth I or something, you know. People like doing that. Why is Genesis 10 and 11 important from a genealogical point of view? Think about that, and we'll talk about that next week, because it was important to somebody who's mentioned at the beginning of chapter 12. Okay, comments or questions on anything we covered tonight? We are on the cusp, y'all, of getting into that patriarchal age where we get into some real familiar stories, and hopefully that'll be enjoyable too. All right, thanks for your comments, your attention tonight. It's an enjoyable study. Hopefully it's moving along at a pace that's good for all you guys.